Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Good to have you along. Welcome to a Wednesday. This is Ash Wednesday as well, Ted, beginning of Lent.
That's right. 40 days till Easter.
Yeah, are you giving anything up, or is that?
I think I'm just constantly trying to improve myself, you know, in different ways, and we'll make it till heaven, but, you know,
that's true.
What they say. So I don't have anything in particular this year, but my daughter is looking at shying away from television.
Okay.
So I'll try to help her with that.
We're going to find out a little bit about maybe some things. You know, some of us grew up in evangelical traditions where it didn't really even register on the calendar.
Yeah.
So we'll find out a bit about that in a moment. I do want to mention, though, that there's an event going on that runs, I think it's run for the past several years during this season. It's 40 Days for Life, and it's a prayer campaign put out by national Right to Life organizations. And you could, go online, find out at 40 Days for Life, and find out where there's gatherings in your state. And I know there are a number of them around the country. So it's a chance to pray for on behalf of life. And they do a lot of prayers out in front of clinics, abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. So just want to make people aware of that. It's a good opportunity to express your convictions there in a very tangible way.
Help your prayer life a bit, yes.
Yeah, no question.
Well, today we're talking about help, by the way, for the church, right?
That's right. Yes, we're going to talk volunteering. So, and my guest volunteered to come in today, and he brought, actually, he recruited volunteers. So we're going to find out about that. Leith Anderson is back with us. He serves as president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and for 35 years was the pastor at the Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. A graduate of Denver Seminary and Fuller Sem, and he's authored more than 20 books, a new one coming out in a month, and we'll talk about that toward the end of the broadcast. But one that he released with Jill Fox not too long ago, in fact, a couple, called The Volunteer Church, Mobilizing Your Congregation for Growth and Effectiveness. And seemed like an appropriate topic to review a bit today. Leith, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Neil. Always great to be with you, and always great to be with KTIS.
We should just mention that in studio, we do actually have some in studio guests. You're doing a little teaching at the Bethel Seminary, right, this week?
So, yeah. I am. All week this week, I'm teaching in the Doctor of Ministry program at Bethel Seminary. So one of the things we talk about is communication in that particular course about leading and managing your ministry. So we're communicating.
All right.
And we'll talk about it afterwards and find out how we did.
Okay. So one of us is going to get a test at the end of the day. I think that's what we know for sure. Leith, before we talk a little bit about the volunteer church and, you know, the importance of really seeing people engaged in serving in ministry, today is the beginning of Lent. I'm interested to know, as your years of pastoring, if the Lenten season was something that you really focused on, and was it a key part of the church calendar for you?
Yeah, we did. So there were Ash Wednesday services. When I was pastor at Wooddale Church, we'd have one at noontime, and then the exact same service again in the evening. And they were just exceptionally well attended. And that was for Lent, but then have Lenten services all through the lead up to Easter. And they were well attended as well. They were over the lunch hour, so set up so that people could come to the service and also get lunch and still be back at work within an hour.
You know, as I mentioned, you know, a lot of us grew up in traditions where it wasn't even on the calendar. So, I mean, what can we maybe learn or make this 40 days leading up to Easter more meaningful?
Well, they're long and old traditions for Lent, and admittedly, there are some of our Protestant traditions that have never really engaged that. I think it's good. I think it's great that we start on Ash Wednesday, we acknowledge that we are sinners, we confess that we need to repent, and that we are using this time up to the marking of Jesus' crucifixion and his resurrection as a time of spiritual commitment and renewal.
And oftentimes that's involving people giving up something probably. So, but is that the important part of this?
Well, it's a tangible expression of a spiritual commitment, and People choose different things, different ways of expressing it. It may be a new discipline in studying the Bible or prayer. I remember one time in a sermon, I suggested that everybody give up Facebook for Lent. That didn't go over too well. audible groan. And that there's a threshold on how far people are willing to go, and that was too much.
Apparently too much. All right. Well, let's talk about what people are willing to do, maybe in terms of serving the church. We're going to talk a little bit about volunteering. Maybe say a word about the book Volunteering, because it's actually kind of a little two-book set, I guess, came out from Zondervan just recently.
Yeah, last year. There are two books. One's a little bit bigger than the other one, and the bigger one is called The Volunteer Church, co-written with Jill Fox, my colleague on the church staff. And it's mainly for leaders. It talks about how you recruit leaders, or how you recruit volunteers, and how you pay them, and how you get them assigned to specific projects. The smaller one is actually sort of the same thing, but it's specifically for the volunteers. So it's kind of an abbreviated version. It's much less expensive. And the idea here is that church leaders would get and read and study and commit to the volunteer church, but then they would provide copies of the book Volunteering to all of their volunteers.
We do have a couple of copies of both books we'll give away here at the end of the hour. So if you'd like to register for one of those, whenever we have resources, we always love to give them away. Do a drawing at the end of the hour. You can call 877-933-2484. To join in with us, 877-933-2484, and give us your contact information. We'll put you in the drawing for the books. And so let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned something about, paying volunteers. That sort of caught my attention. So isn't the definition of volunteer someone that doesn't get paid?
Well, really not. And I think there's some misunderstandings of how volunteers work and what they do. They're not paid in money, but if volunteers aren't paid, they don't continue to work. So they are paid in training, they are paid in love, they are paid in communication, they're paid in gratitude. And if the pay's not there, pretty much they're going to move on to someplace else where they'll be better paid.
And I guess that's one of the challenges, that people do move on when they're volunteering, right? It's not something that people tend to do for a lifetime, although maybe some do.
Some do. I've known Sunday school teachers that have taught continuously for 40 years, and they've transformed lives. And much of their week revolves around teaching that Sunday school class on Sunday morning. However, most of us volunteer in certain chapters, and we need to understand, as those that are recruiting, which chapter of life people are in. We know, for example, that one of the highest percentages of demographic volunteering is among teenagers. Teenagers are great at volunteering. And we have a suspicion that what we should really do is get people who are empty nesters or retired, and they should volunteer in the nursery, and they don't. Largely, I mean, some do, obviously, but many people who are empty nesters or retired, they figure, I've reached my lifetime quota of changing diapers and doing all the things that are related to the nursery, and now it's somebody else's time. And in Sunday school children's ministries, the most likely people to volunteer are those that have children that are in that particular age group. So it's figuring out who fits where and then matching them up to that.
So does the old rule still apply that 80% or 20% do 80% of the work? Is that true in a church serving as well?
Well, yeah, it is. And sometimes it's a 90-10 rule. But often it's because we've not adequately recruited, it's because we've not adequately paid, and often it's because we've not asked. The number one reason that people volunteer is because they're asked. It's the same thing with giving, that the number one reason that people donate to a charity or a church is because somebody asked them to do it. But there's a difference between somebody making an announcement on a Sunday morning, "You all, we need you to help out." That's not a very effective means of recruiting, but when an individual asks, if you ask me or I ask you, we're much more likely to volunteer.
And how many asks does it take? I mean, I think sometimes we, if we get a phone salesman, we can, say no three or four times before they finally hang up. So is that?
Well, stranger asks are not as effective as relationship asks. The best people at recruiting are people who are also involved in that ministry. So, for example, if you have volunteers, let's say, who are young adults who are working in junior high ministry in the church, they are really good at recruiting other people, especially other people their age, to work in the same junior high ministry, maybe even to the point of having a waiting list of people that are anxious to do it. because these are people that are involved and they do it themselves. Now, on the other hand, if I've never been to a junior high group and I don't have a junior high child and I ask you, whom I don't know, are you willing to teach junior high Sunday school? The chances of getting a yes or less.
Maybe we should, start with the why. I don't know if we really touched on that, but I mean, why? I guess in the first place, why do people volunteer?
Well, they volunteer for a lot of reasons. Some do it out of guilt. Some do it out of delight. But most people volunteer because they really want to make a difference and they really want to give back. And the best volunteers are those who, at the end of the day or the end of the year, say, you know, I actually got more out of it than I put into it. And that's often the case with volunteers. They feel they've really made a difference. So back to empty nesters or those that are retired, one of the favorite volunteers is to go to camps or to go to missions and to help out in ways that maybe are unaffordable to those that run those ministries. Repeatedly, I've heard people who have paid all their own expenses, who have gone with significant sacrifice, say, I want to do this again next year because I got so much out of it. I got friendships. I got all kinds of good things as a result.
Thinking about some of those RV groups that go around to camps and things and a little bit of construction work or something, and they have a great time and work for part of the day and enjoy each other's company the rest.
Well, and the enjoying each other's company is a big part of it. Several years ago, I led a tour group that went to the Middle East. We went to Turkey and Greece. And I was talking to this man who was in the group. I didn't really know him very well. And I said, so you came because you wanted to see the lands of the Bible. He said, you could have gone to South America or Alaska. I would have come either way. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you know, I just moved to Minnesota and I don't know anybody. And I figured if I signed up for a group of people that are going for 14 days where I've got to have all the meals with them, I'm going to get some friends out of it and it will be a worthwhile investment. So he did it for a completely different reason than you would expect. And there are many people who volunteer. They just want to be part of a community. They want to have friends. And so they volunteer to do it, and they get the friendships. They build the relationships. So there are a lot of reasons, and there are good reasons, and we ought to sort of validate them all.
Hey, you may have a reason that you decided to do some serving in church. I'd love to hear from you today, or maybe you have a question about it. You might be in a ministry that's needing some recruits. We'd love to hear from you today. You can join the conversation at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. We're talking about the volunteer church. How do you mobilize your congregation for growth and effectiveness? That's the subtitle of a new little book out from Leith Anderson and Jill Fox. Leith Anderson is president of the National Association of Evangelicals and 35 years was pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Joining us today, he's authored a number of books. We're talking volunteering, serving, and more. We're going to get some perspective from Leith on maybe what hinders us. You know, should we serve if our heart's not in it? And we'll go on to get more conversation in a moment ahead. Again, you're welcome to join us. We have some copies of the books to give away. You can sign up for that and share your volunteer story. How has it changed your life? We'd love to hear it. 877-933-2484. The people with the right attitude and the right smile and capable can really change the atmosphere of a church. You're trying to be welcoming and inviting and be effective in ministry. Well, the right people in the right place serving can make all the difference. We're talking about the volunteer church today, mobilizing your congregation for growth and effectiveness. That's the title of the new book from Leith Anderson, also co-written with Jill Fox, who was, I think, one of the volunteer coordinators during your years at Wooddale Church. Is she still doing that? Okay. By the way, we do have some copies to give away, and you can join us at 877-93-FAITH if you'd like to sign up for those. Talking with Leith Anderson about mobilizing the church, and I'm wondering if we talked about some of the why. Is there maybe a primary reason why people don't serve?
People don't serve because they don't know what they're getting themselves into, or they've had a bad experience, or probably they haven't been recruited very well. If someone has had a bad experience, then the best way to recruit them is to not ask them to do the whole project, but say, why don't you come along for 1 hour, one time, and just see what you think. And if they have a positive experience doing that, they're most likely to do it. They're reluctant, and it's good to make a long-term commitment without knowing what they're getting into. But mismatch is another huge challenge. If I've got the gift of evangelism and you're putting me in a ministry that has no evangelism in it, then I'm in the wrong place. If I'm a teacher, then I probably shouldn't be in a role where there is no teaching. So it's getting the gift mix right too. I would actually, and have done this, had people who were recruited to do something that was a mismatch and said, don't do it. Let's just get you in the right place.
But I suppose the reality is most of us maybe don't really know, right? I mean, I think Bill Hybels always talks about, you know, just jump in the pool. You know, you may not land in the center of the pool, but just jump in. And so do we allow that maybe that mismatching to go for a while until someone really finds their sweet spot?
We may do that. However, if it's the pool is music and you can't carry a tune, you probably should stay on the deck.
And the rest of us would thank you,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. So I think just experimenting, learning is helpful. It's also really helpful that people are in teams. We are much more likely to volunteer and we're much more likely to sustain it if we're with a group of people. If I have to volunteer all by myself and I'm in isolation, that means that if I'm sick, if I go on vacation, it doesn't get done. But if you and I are together on a team, then, you know, I'm part of a group. It's a good thing, and I'm more likely to stick with it. I think overall we need to understand that the church is a volunteer organization. It's kind of unusual that in America we've hired so many people to do jobs that in the past have been done by volunteers, and it's simply not financially sustainable for churches to keep paying people to do things. So we need to be the volunteer organization that the church has usually been.
Are we the way we're sort of doing church now in terms of our volunteer service? Does that represent, do you think, what the first century church or what Jesus had in mind originally? I mean, are we on track in terms of how we do church today?
Well, keep in mind the early church was a lot of slaves, a lot of people that certainly weren't going to be paid to do something. They were volunteers. And they were excited about the challenge. It's not dissimilar to what's happening in an election year with a presidential campaign where each candidate has thousands, tens of thousands of people to volunteer. And it's true that there's a lot of money involved in politics, but mostly it's volunteers. And when your friend, your neighbor says, why don't you come knocking on doors with me? We'll do it together. Or make phone calls. You say, yeah, I'll give it a try. If it doesn't work out, then I might not do it anymore.
Well, then brings up, I guess, the question is a length of time. Is that a factor? Say, well, you know, let's just make this commitment for an hour a week, or maybe it's just a one-time thing, or, you know, we want you to sign up for the next 9 months to be teaching junior high.
Well, it's more difficult to make a long-term commitment, but as a church, we need to decide that we're not going to have a different Sunday school teacher every week or every month, because that continuity of relationship is part of the discipling process. So that makes it a little bit more challenging and difficult. But let's suppose that somebody is teaching junior hires and then someone else is brought in as an assistant for a week or for a month, and then they start building the relationships. They see how it's good, that it's valuable, that they get a return on their time investment as volunteers. They're very likely to commit for 9 months or for a year.
Do you have – you mentioned you know some people that have served for 40 years on Sunday school. I mean, do you have some stories of maybe, you know, good experiences and some bad experiences maybe in your church history as you've pastored along the way?
Well, I've had some volunteers when I was growing up who were wonderfully influential in my life, and it was the relationship that I most remember. I probably shouldn't say this, but I remember my Sunday school teacher who brought coffee cake every week because he worked for a bakery. I remember another Sunday school teacher who owned a horse and taught me horseback riding. I probably learned Bible and the gospel from them as well, but the relationship profoundly affected my life. And then we all have stories of people that have negatively affected our lives. That's less likely to happen if it's a team. If it's a team of people that are working together in Vacation Bible School or on a short-term missions trip, if someone is operating negatively, the others are probably going to correct that and fix it. And if the person is a loner, then it can be terrific or it could become dangerous.
Because the volunteers do represent what the face of the church, right? And the beliefs, the doctrines, the values. So, I mean, you want your best face forward, right? These are your customer service people.
Of course you do. But my experience is that the problem is rare. They're not. I'm trying. You said a negative story. I'm actually not thinking of a negative story. Volunteers that I have known, and I've known thousands of them, these are good people. They're caring, they're committed, and they do a terrific job. The difficulty is when they're in the wrong place or they don't know what to do. They don't have the resources, they don't have the training, and then we need to help them get it right.
Let's talk about resource and training. What are the things that we often overlook in that area?
Well, often there is no training. It's you take over because somebody else has left, and we wouldn't do that in much of any other area of life. So training can be really simple. It can be as simple as an orientation session that lasts for a half an hour or an hour. The best of training is hands-on training. It's when you stand next to somebody who has done it and has done it well, and you watch how they do it, and then you follow that example. So bringing somebody along for a week or a month goes a long way to equipping them to continue.
And by resource, I mean, there are probably some churches say, you know, the reason that we need volunteers is we don't have budget to, you know, provide these things. So I guess there's more ways to resource ministry than just maybe money, right?
Well, money may be part of it, yeah. To provide an adequate place for a Sunday school class to meet or for transportation for people to go out and serve the community. However, money really is in some ways a liability more than an asset. A true volunteer organization, volunteers, by the way, and there's some research on this, volunteers actually give more money to the church and to the ministry because they're engaged in it. So recruiting volunteers can actually enhance the budget of the church. Many times volunteers underwrite the project that they're involved in, or they go out and they recruit money to come in and support what they're about. But to start out by saying we don't have the money to do this is really a misunderstanding of how the church should work and how volunteers should serve.
When we return after a quick break, we'll follow up on that and say, if we don't have people willing to take on a program, does that mean the church should drop the program? Or on the other hand, if someone really has a passion for something, should the church add that to the list and become the equipper for the volunteers? We'll talk about that and more. We're talking The Volunteering Church, The Volunteer Church. It's a new book from Leith Anderson and Jill Fox. Leith Anderson is president of the National Association of Evangelicals and has served for 35 years, was pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, joining us in studio today. You're welcome to join us as well. I'd love to hear your volunteer story. How has it made a difference in your life? It'd be great to know about your service experience. 877-933-2484. Tell us why you serve and how it's made a difference in your life. And we also have some copies of Lee's book to give away. So we'll do that at the end of the hour. You can sign up for that with a phone call at 877-933-2484. Or if you'd rather, you can submit your question via email. If you go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page, there's an email link there. You can submit your question. MyFaithRadio.com. Click on Connecting Faith, and we'll talk more with Leith Anderson in just a couple minutes. We're talking to help and the church serving in ministry together. What does that look like? How can we do it better? Maybe why do we do it? We're interested in your stories, too. If you've got the story to tell, as we talk volunteering today, serving in your church, maybe what you appreciate about it, how it's made a difference in your life, you can call us at 877-933-2484. Talking about the volunteer church, mobilizing your congregation for growth and effectiveness is the title of a new little resource from Leith Anderson and Jill Fox. Leith has served for 35 years as pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, and is now a president of the National Association of Evangelicals and is joining us in studio today. And Leith, we talked just a little bit before the break about, you know, kind of we're talking finding people's unique gift mix. So if no one wants to serve in a particular area, does that mean the church should drop the program?
It's sort of a yes or no kind of question. It depends on what is the program. So I, for example, for years prayed that we would be able to establish a ministry for people with disabilities. And we just couldn't get the right volunteers. And seriously, prayed for and tried to recruit people for multiple years, gave up. And maybe two or three years later, some volunteers showed up. They actually introduced the idea, and it launched a tremendous ministry. So that was really a positive experience out of a disappointment. We got by with not having that ministry until the time we had that ministry. The other side of it is, if a church has a Sunday school program that goes first through sixth grade and you don't have a teacher for fourth and fifth grade, you can't skip those years. So that means the pressure is on even to recruit some people that might not choose to do it and ask them to do it on an interim basis until we can get the right people. But we've got to fully serve the congregation that God has called us to serve. Obviously, if in radio you don't have somebody that's going to be able to be on the air between 9 and 10 in the morning, you can't just shut down between 9 and 10 in the morning. So some things you have to continue doing and other things you can get by without.
Is the pastor responsible to see that all the positions are filled?
I hope not. I hope not. And I don't think pastors are usually the best recruiters. I think the pastors, though, are the best ones at saying that this is a high value to the congregation, that this is really important to teach biblical concepts of spiritual gifts and the values that can be gained by serving God first and then serving God's people. The best recruiters are people that are in that ministry. The ushers are the best recruiters to get ushers. The musicians are the best recruiters to get musicians because they know the answers to all the questions. They typically have relationships with people that are like that, and they're just really good at it. And it's just natural. It's comfortable. And it often isn't comfortable for a pastor to recruit somebody to do something that the pastor isn't directly involved in himself or herself.
But it probably needs to be, doesn't need to be specific from the pulpit. So he said, hey, we need people to help us here, as opposed to say we need someone at the 5 o'clock service or the, you know, whatever it might be.
Well, my choice is actually to not make the announcement from the pulpit. I think it's better to have a personal relationship and a personal conversation. And if the announcement, rather than the announcement from the pulpit, let's just talk about Jesus Christ and talk about what the Bible asks us to do and then set the mood for the recruiters to go and base it off that rather than saying, you know, we're kind of desperate. We don't have somebody for eighth grade this year.
So on the other hand, you sort of touched on it. If a person comes to you and says, hey, I really think we need a program for maybe a recovery ministry here at church, do you start one up? How do you handle that? Someone comes to you or church leadership and say, we need to be doing this.
Is this the fifth time I've said it depends?
Okay, all right. Well,
you know,
what was that?
It depends. If you already know the person and the person has responsibility and credibility, you might fast track it. If it's somebody you're not sure about them, you don't know them well, you can start out by saying, why don't you write a proposal? And if the person's serious about it, they'll do that. So write a proposal that's no more than 2 pages long, and then let's sit down and talk about it and pray about it. Let's consider doing a short-term recovery program rather than making a one-year commitment to it. Let's do this one time and see what happens and then where we need to go from there.
We've talked a little bit about the most successful way that volunteers are recruited is by asking. So is there any sort of more advice we should talk about that in terms of how the ask should be made?
Well, ask in a way that says, I've done it, and it's been great, and you'll like it, and I'll show you how to do it, and I'll give you a chance to check it out. And if it's not the right thing, we're still going to be friends with each other, and it'll be okay.
Which I guess brings up, is there, have you ever had to sort of maybe fire a volunteer? Or just, I think you sort of touched on it. I guess if someone's not in their gift mix, say, that can be sort of uncomfortable. So, you know, it's clear that you're not really thriving here.
There's a section in the book about how to fire volunteers, and the best way to do it is don't talk about firing volunteers. It's sort of saying, Neil, you know, really grateful to have you on the radio, but there's a lot of snow out there, and you're really good at plowing snow. So why don't we just take you away from the microphone and give you a snow plow and give them something else to do that probably is more fitting? In extreme cases, I guess you actually step up and say, you're not going to do this anymore. I can't much remember ever having to do that.
just because it's about relationships ultimately, isn't it? About,
yeah. Do you yeah. like to plow snow?
I actually, yeah, that would be, Ted started cheering when that came up. So what about, I'm sure you've had, in your years in ministry, you've had successful, maybe high-skill people, come to your church, and they have more to offer than maybe handing out bulletins, or maybe that's what they want to do. How do you engage and motivate someone that's really at a high-skill level in certain areas?
Sometimes we sort of assume that because someone is a physician or a Sunday school teacher or a business executive during the week, that that's what they want to do on weekends. And maybe that's true, but often it's not. Often they want to do something that is very different. You have a business executive who loves to sing but really can't sing at staff meetings at a large company, so doesn't want to be in the administration of the church but wants to be in the music ministry of the church. So it's finding out what is that person's gift and what is that person's interest. On the other hand, there are those who are really good at something. They do it during the week, and they want to bring that same skill and level of experience over to the life of the church. Interviewing them, talking with them, probably not in the formal interview sense, but let's go out to lunch together. Tell me about you. Where do you have passions? What are you interested in? So it's not starting with filling a position. It's starting with the person and who you are and how we can best minister to you by putting you in the place where you can serve God and others.
So do you, in your church experience, did you do a lot of come discover your gift kind of sessions, training sessions, programs like that?
I taught a class on spiritual gifts for, I hate to admit it, 25, 30 years straight, and it would be maybe 50 people at a time. And it was one of the more popular courses that we ever offered. And I think it was transformational in the lives of a lot of people. It was the freedom to know that I should do and I should be what God designed me to be, rather than that I have to, out of guilt or pressure or some other reason, take on a task just because it's an organizational need. And then giving people an opportunity to take some quizzes, write some stuff, do some study, ask around, what do you see me doing? What are my gifts? And I think it was just marvelous, and I think it was impactful in the church.
It probably gives people an opportunity to say no with confidence, then, right, for things that they aren't gifted at or they don't want to do.
Well, there's some things we just can't do. In another sense, let me just say that when I was 5 years old, my mother decided that I should be a musician. So she signed me up with a piano teacher, who sent a note home after a year or so saying, I don't ever want to see him again. And then the piano teacher's wife took me on. And then after a couple of years, she sent me home with a note saying, I don't want to see him again. And my mother, she couldn't get this. So I took piano lessons for 8 years, and I never finished the second book. And that's because I can't play the piano. I can't carry a tune. And unlike my mother, people need to see that somebody can't do something. It's okay. But what can that person do? And then they're going to delight in ministry that's in their wheelhouse.
Yeah. There's a lot of conversation these days about the millennial generation, the skeptical of traditional church, maybe more cause-focused than kind of institutions. So are millennials interested in serving in different ways in the church, have you found?
Millennials are those born approximately from 1980 into the early part of this century. So actually, millennials are as old as 36 years old in 2016. If they're 36 years old and they have children, then they are going to have different volunteer interests than those who are 22 years old and perhaps not married, don't have children. It's going to be determined by where they are in their own life chapter and journey. However, we clearly know that younger adults, and that younger adult category is moving into middle age, are people who want to be engaged with other people. If they give money, they don't want to just give the money. They want to see where it goes. They want to participate. They want to be connected. There's a lot of interest in the evangelical community among younger Christians in social justice and what's happening in our culture and around the world. We see it in advocacy for trafficking, for example, and many, many other ways. So it's supporting a child through compassion or world vision, lots of different ways of connection. But I'm really encouraged by younger Christian adults engaging in the life of the church, and especially in volunteering. So what's coming is really good and really interesting and really exciting.
So if someone is volunteering or engaged in a ministry outside the local church, are they still a valuable member of the congregation?
They are not only a valuable member, but I have often publicly said, if you have a choice between using your spiritual gift outside the life of the church and inside the life of the church, go outside the life of the church. Volunteer within the community. We'll find somebody else to fill the position within the church. Some people may worry and say, oh, if we really did that, then everybody would be outside the church. That's not going to happen. There are a sufficient number of people within the church, and we need to get outside the walls. That's evangelistic. It's serving the community. It's addressing social justice. It's doing a lot of really good things. So, yeah, that's where I think they should go first, if that's their gift and that's their calling and that's their opportunity.
And maybe that's a little different mindset for many churches who get kind of used to looking inward, and to actually sort of equip and send someone out with their blessing. Is that a shift in attitude for many pastors or leaders?
I would say that that's a biblical concept. It's go and make disciples of all nations, be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, and everywhere. It's what it means to be a Christian. The idea is not that we are contained within a social setting that's called a church. It's that we are the agents of Jesus Christ within our society. So, of course, we ought to be doing it. It ought to be that the first people that anybody would think of for a volunteer in the community is somebody from the church, somebody who's a Christian, because they're good at it and because they're committed and because they're faithful. They're the best that you can get.
Talking with Leith Anderson today about volunteering, referencing a new book that he and Jill Fox have co-written. Actually, there's a couple little books. There's The Volunteer Church, and the subtitle is Mobilizing Your Congregation for Growth and Effectiveness. And there's also Volunteering, which is a companion. It's a guide to serving in the body of Christ, both from Zondervan. We've got a couple copies to give away. We'll do that at the end of the hour. You can sign up at 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. And we'll come back and talk more with Leith Anderson in just a moment. President of the National Association of Evangelicals. We'll get a little update on what's on the NAE plate today and talk a little about a new book he has coming out. It has to do with politics. A timely conversation just ahead. Stay tuned to Connecting Faith. At North Point Church, large church. Leith Anderson is president of the National Association of Evangelicals, served at Wooddale Church for 35 years. That was a fairly large church as well. Does it make a difference, large church or small church? I know the average attendance nationwide church is 100 or 200 or less. So does it make a difference if you have 80 as opposed to 800 or 8,000?
There are different opportunities, but no, the church is a volunteer organization, and that's exactly what it should be. The median-sized church in America is 75 at worship on Sunday morning, and a church that has 250 is in the 95th percentile. So most churches, by far, are churches of less than 200, and that's the epicenter of ministry, of churches, and of volunteering.
Does that, when you take on the leadership role of the National Association of Evangelicals, realizing that you're representing thousands and thousands, but they're all together in kind of small groups, aren't they? I mean, you're representing an awful lot of small churches.
We have about 45,000 churches, so they range from the largest churches in America to house churches that have just started up. It's the whole diverse variety, and it is just wonderful to see the different ways of the expression of the body of Christ. It's just terrific.
Is there anything that's on the front burner these days at the NAE that you're, I'm sure there's plenty to be concerned about. What's primary in your desk these days?
There are a lot of projects. We have religious freedom issues in government that deal with concerns coming out of the Supreme Court's past rulings. So that's a major concern. We have the World Relief, which is one of the nine agencies that the federal government uses to resettle refugees. and a lot of refugees, and that has become a topic of debate in America. We have just undertaken a major project and are grateful for significant funding of it that's come from the Lilly Endowment to address pastor finances in America. We find that there are too many older pastors who don't have money for retirement and they're not retiring. And on the other hand, we have younger pastors who have oppressive student debt in tens of thousands of dollars, sometimes $50,000, $60,000. And these new pastors marry someone who may have another debt of $40,000. So you're going into an occupation that doesn't pay terrifically well and maybe have $50,000 or $100,000 in student debt. So we are addressing that in a major way. We're just in the process of hiring staff for it. We're working with multiple member denominations. We have 40 member denominations. And it's educating churches and pastors as practical ways of doing things. And we hope to really partner with others in making a difference in clergy finances in America.
Does that mean that maybe coming a day where pastors have less sort of traditional training because they simply can't afford to take on that debt?
There have been switches in that, and it depends on the tradition from which you come. So some of our denominations require a seminary degree to be ordained. Others don't have that type of requirement. I think one of the shifts that we have seen in the past generation is it used to be you went to school and then you went into pastoral ministry. More and more, we see people that will go on a church staff or become bivocational or maybe even volunteer, and they have ministry experience before they go to school, or it's simultaneous. So that's somewhat different. We have a lot of bivocational pastors in America, and that's especially true in the immigrant community and many ethnic communities. So it's how we address that and how we help them so that really it's so that they're not so worried about money that they can't minister to people. And churches need to step up and pay fair salaries. And how does that take place? How do they raise the money to do it? One of my favorite stories is a church in Indiana, a congregation of 100, and the pastor had $20,000 in debt. He was in trouble, and he was discouraged by it. And the pastor and the leadership of the church came together in a Saturday seminar where they learned some basic principles. But one of them was the church leadership didn't know about his financial situation, and he never talked to the church leadership about it. And this plateaued church of 100, the leaders went back, and they raised $20,000, and they paid all of his debt. And they're so excited. It's given new life to the church. So it really wasn't just about the money. It was that they did something successfully. And the last I heard, now they're trying to raise money to buy him a new car. So if we could repeat stories like that across America, it would be great for churches and great for pastors.
Well, you know, we spent most of the hour talking about volunteering. And you said that, you know, those that volunteer tend to give more because they get invested in the project. And we know that, you know, America is, you know, one of the most giving nations. And yet the church statistically, numbers don't give as significantly as they could. I mean, maybe just say a word about a challenge to people to is the way to start increasing our heart for giving, to start more serving, more volunteering.
Generosity is a powerful tool in the life of the donor. It really makes a difference. Sometimes in churches, we give the notion that you've got to start with a tithe. I would say if people aren't giving, that they start with a dollar and that they be disciplined and thoughtful in how they go about it. Again, one of the main reasons that people don't give in America is that nobody asks them. And it's a difference between standing up on a stewardship Sunday once a year, and some people avoid that Sunday and don't come to church that Sunday, and being asked as an individual, would you participate with me in the support of this missionary? Would you help out in the support of this child? Would you be willing to come with me on a trip to Mexico this summer and volunteer? But you'll have to bring some money along to do it. When asked specifically and personally, many people who have the resources to do it, they step up and give.
We've got a couple of minutes left, I guess 5 minutes left. Let's talk about the new book just coming out on relating to politics. Is that right?
It is. It comes out on the 15th of March, and it's a co-authored book with my colleague with the National Association of Evangelicals. His name is Galen Carey. It was initiated by HarperCollins, so they came to us and asked us to write a book that says, how do Christians, and specifically evangelical Christians, engage politics in America? It's not a book that's telling people who to vote for, but it is telling them how to vote. In one chapter, it's actually the specifics of how to register and how to find out who the candidates are and how to do it. But it's especially a call to Christians to start with what the Bible says and not start with what a political party or a cable news program says. I'll give you an example. When Lifeway Research did some polling to find out how evangelical Christians have shaped their thinking about American immigration policy, it was discovered that there are more, percentage-wise and certainly in absolute numbers, who get their ideas from cable television than those who get it from the Bible, their church, and their pastor combined. And our call is to start with the Bible. It's not that we don't watch television. It's not that we don't have interest in a political party. But let's find out what the Bible says first. For example, on immigration, there are 92 verses in the Bible that are very specific about how we treat immigrants. Let's be able to quote them and then decide what our politics are going to be.
You know, some would say, well, I'm, you know, if the candidate is not my sort of exact religious persuasion, then I'm just not going to vote at all. How do you respond to kind of those that are, you know, I'm going to win the battle, but maybe we lose the war?
Sometimes that may be appropriate, but we would not take that approach with firefighters or ambulance drivers or physicians or dentists or a whole lot of other critically important roles in life. We want to have people who are in government who are competent to do what they're supposed to do. We're probably never going to get 100% alignment. That means that if we write down a list of what our 12 principles or priorities are, we should put them in order and we should seek an alignment with one or two or three, but not expect alignment with all of them. It's not likely that we're going to get that. And Christian faith is highly valuable. I would much prefer that I am voting for somebody who shares my Christian faith. But I also recognize that someone needs to be competent to be the commander in chief. And if I can't perfectly align those, then I need to make a decision on what is my highest priority in voting. The title of the book is Faith in the Voting Booth. And that actually has a double meaning. So it's bringing my Christian faith into the voting booth, but it's also having faith in our democracy and our democratic processes for voting. So it's faith in the voting booth both directions.
Well, and you've had opportunity to travel enough to know that we you know, despite democracy's challenges, it's what the best of the worst, I think. Was it Winston Churchill maybe said that? But I mean,
I think it was Churchill who said, if you want to find out what's wrong with democracy, talk to five people.
Yes. You know, that's true, too. Yes, the average voter, yes. Maybe it works in New Hampshire. I don't know. We're not going to comment any more about that. You're being an East Coast native, I guess. But Lee, thanks so much for coming by today and encouraging us. If people want to find out more about National Association of Evangelicals, I mean, there are a number of resources and ways that they could probably be connected, right, to the great work you're doing.
And if you want to look at a website, it's nae.net. And as I mentioned, we have 40 member denominations and a whole range of evangelical organizations, schools, colleges, universities, churches, publishing houses, relief agencies. They're all together in representing between 90 and 100 million evangelical Christians in America.
You can find out more about their good work, nae.net. Leith Anderson is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and for 35 years was pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie. He is author of more than 20 books. There's a new one coming out here in a month called Faith in the Voting Booth. It'll be timely. I encourage you to look for that, and maybe we'll connect with Leith again when that arrives. Glad to have you listening today here on Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's show or maybe want to pass it on to a friend, all our interviews are posted on our website, on our show page, and they're all shareable. So it's a great way to just pass the word along and let others know. And you can do that by going to our website, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page and see the podcast archives of this conversation and many others available for you there at the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for joining us here on Connecting Faith.